California Dreaming is brought to you by Blueberry. You know, there is a little bit more to making a podcast than just talking into a mic and hitting publish. You need more than that. And I'm talking about a reliable hosting service so your time can be spent working on your show. You also want accurate download numbers. You want to see the audience that you're reaching. And you're going to want a webpage that is simple and easy to work with. That's why I choose Blueberry. With its simple media hosting and fully integrated WordPress website, it can't get any easier. So if you host a show, or if you're thinking about starting one, visit www.orbitaljigsaw.com/dream to give Blueberry a try for a month for free. Blueberry's support team will be right there every step of the way to help you migrate over so you won't lose any of your subscribers in the process. And if you're brand new to this, they can get your new show up and running. And with a month for free to try it out using promo code DREAM, what have you got to lose? There are a number of ways you can support California Dreaming. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can spread the word about the show. You can recommend us in podcast and true crime fan groups. And you can leave the show a rating and a review on iTunes or whichever platform you listen to the show on. And if you would like to go a little above and beyond, you can also support the show on Patreon. For as little as $1 a month, you can gain access to one exclusive bonus per month, and there are currently more than 30 episodes that you can binge, so it's a pretty good deal for just a dollar. This week, I posted an announcement on Patreon. I'll do some shout-outs next time. Just know that I see you. It was a very sweet gesture, and I will get you in the next episode. And if you're not interested in a monthly donation, you can help with a one-time donation to the show through our PayPal using our email, californiapod@gmail.com. Every little bit helps in keeping the show going, so thank you. Because of the delay in this episode, I'm going to go ahead and get right into it without too much of my usual meandering introduction. Our story today, and by the way, today is Friday the 21st, and I just noticed that Dateline went ahead and told the same story that I'm going to tell you today, but it's too late. I already finished this. It's ready to go, so oh well. Anyway, the first word that comes to my mind when I think about this story is senseless. Many crimes are senseless, but sometimes there are ones that stand out more than others, because there are times when the reasons or motives behind a crime were not actually real. What do I mean by that? Well, take for example the recent case out of Ohio, where a 13-year-old boy whose identity has not been revealed murdered 14-year-old Sylvia McGee by shooting her in the head because she told him that she thought she was pregnant. And he was fearful that he was the father. He was sentenced last month to be in the Division of Youth Services until he's 21 years old, and if he commits any violent offenses in that time, then he will be subject to some adult time of 15 years to life. But the thing was, when the autopsy was conducted on Sylvia, it was revealed that she wasn't pregnant. This boy shot her in the head, and she wasn't even pregnant. So many things wrong with that case on so many levels. Children having sex at such a young age. At least to me, that's young. Some of you may agree. I don't know. I'm not going to take a poll here. And then Sylvia thinking that she might be pregnant at only 14 years of age. These two kids having that conversation. A 13 and 14-year-old talking about we might be parents by the time we're freshmen and sophomores in high school. And then the gun. A child that young with access to a loaded gun. And for him to get into that place in his mind that the best course of action would be to shoot Sylvia in the head and kill her. Only to find out that she wasn't pregnant after all. That is what's at the heart of our story today. A tragedy that didn't need to happen because of a reason that was not rooted in reality. in today's 133rd episode of California Dreaming, The Tale of the Moore Family Farm. Our story takes place on a farm located in Colusa County, California, which is located in the Central Valley northwest of our state capital, Sacramento. On July 16, 2011, 43-year-old farm foreperson Roberto Ayala had spent the early part of the afternoon with his 7-year-old son, Fabian. Roberto is married and a father of 3 children, and he himself comes from a huge family with a total of 11 brothers and sisters, including himself. The Ayala family was close, and they were a very, very hardworking bunch. Roberto's family described him as a very kind, generous, and giving person that never denied anyone a helping hand, whether they be family, friends, or even strangers. So Roberto and Fabian had lunch, and afterwards they got into Dad's work truck and headed out to the rice fields located on the southern part of the farmland owned by the Moore family. And I'll talk more about the owners of the farm and their various roles as we go along. Roberto was doing some routine maintenance work and headed out there to check on the panel box that controls the irrigation for about 100 acres of the land. As Roberto got out of the truck, he left it running. He walked over to the box, which was mounted on a utility pole. And as soon as he opened the panel, an explosion erupted, throwing Roberto back a few feet and shattering at least one of the windows of the truck in which Fabian was still seated. Roberto landed on the ground on his back, and he lay there motionless. His son rushed over to his dad, yelling out his name, but Roberto was unresponsive, and he was on fire. Fabian tried to reach for his dad's cell phone, which was in one of his pockets, but the fire prevented him from being able to retrieve it to make a call for help. So he ran for 2 miles or 3.2 kilometers through some fields to the closest residence that he could find, where he was able to get the homeowners to call 911 for him. The woman who made the 911 call said, "This little boy just showed up. He's completely covered in mud. He said something blew up and there's a fire. And I don't know where this boy's dad is. His name is Fabian Ayala." The first person on the scene was Fire Chief Jeff Winters, but it was clear that there was nothing that could be done. Roberto had succumbed to his injuries. Noticing Roberto's truck was still running, Chief Winters turned the ignition off and called for law enforcement. He reported that he had a fatality, and he conducted a cursory look over the scene. His first impression was that this was some sort of electrical malfunction with the control panel box. Word started getting around the small rural community that something had happened to Roberto, that there was some sort of explosion, and before long, Roberto's brother, Eduardo, who also worked on the farm, his phone started ringing with people telling him that something's happened, there's been an accident, and something's happened to Roberto. He tried calling his brother's phone, he left voicemails, but he'd never get a response. Eduardo would eventually get the news that his brother was gone. And for the life of everyone who knew him, nobody could imagine that there was anyone that would want to do any harm to Roberto. So like I said, this is why the initial thought was that this must have been an accident. Why would anyone want to hurt the dedicated family man and farm foreperson? Roberto's injuries were quite extensive, and the burns were described as fourth-degree burns, which I've so rarely heard of. And in looking at burn classifications, the degrees actually extend all the way up to the sixth degree. First degree is damage to the outer layers of skin and usually heal within a week. This would be something like a sunburn. Second degree burns damage the outer layer of the skin and the layer just beneath it. A skin graft might be necessary to cover it while it heals, and there may be some minimal scarring. Third-degree burns destroy both layers of skin and hair follicles, sweat glands, and underlying tissues. They require skin grafts to help in healing. Fourth-degree burns, which Roberto suffered, extends to the fatty tissues. Fifth-degree burns reach the muscles, and sixth-degree burns all the way to the bone. I don't know if it was any consolation to the Ayala family, but Roberto did die instantly from the explosion. It detonated at chest level, and when first responders arrived, he was still on fire. He had pieces of metal shrapnel in his chest, neck, face, and embedded in his brain. The initial thought was that this was some sort of high-voltage electrocution. And when the pathologist initially examined Roberto's body, he opined that his cause of death was a combination of the explosive shrapnel injuries and electrocution. But Fire Chief Winters, he wasn't so sure. In his line of work, he had been at the scene of electrical explosions in the past, but nothing that seemed to have exploded with the same kind of ferocity and intensity as the one that killed Roberto. They were looking at the wires and thought it was possible that there was some kind of corrosion which led to a massive power surge. Their only witness was 7-year-old Fabian. He told investigators that his dad had gone to turn on the water pump in order to adjust the water levels of the rice fields when it suddenly exploded like a massive bomb. Fabian told investigators what he could and eventually was brought back to be with his family. Representatives from Pacific Gas and Electric, or PG&E, were summoned to the scene to make their own assessment of the accident. The control box was a pretty substantial one in size. It was about 1.5 feet or 45 centimeters wide, 2.5 feet or 76 centimeters tall, and about 12 inches or 30 centimeters deep. So when PG&E took a close look at the box and the wiring, it was determined that when there is an accidental explosion, the damage is primarily to the electrical lines, which causes some charring to the electrical box itself. But this thing exploded like a bomb, not an electrical surge. The PG&E investigator pointed out that they've seen electrical explosions caused by surges, but this was by far the most damage they'd ever seen. PG&E strongly urged them to call for further investigation into this, to take a look, because this, based on the intensity of the explosion, the thinking started shifting that it may have been something that was deliberately set. Something planted that was meant to be victim detonated. So investigators called upon the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, or the ATF, for assistance with the investigation. Special Agent Brian Parker arrived at the scene. Evidence that was scattered about was being collected, and it soon became apparent that there were pieces of debris, wiring, and other components that were not associated with the control panel box itself. Once everything was gathered, sorted, and examined, the ATF made the determination that there was indeed an explosive device that had been planted inside the box, and that this was a deliberate act meant to maim or kill, meaning Roberto Ayala's death was intentional. But the investigators were still unsure because this explosion did not have any of the earmarks of a typical domestic or foreign act of terrorism, where specific targets are chosen to maximize damage and casualties. This was a bomb on a farm that killed one innocuous farm employee. So investigators decided to first talk to the owners of the farm, a 70-year-old man named Roger Moore and his younger brother, Gus Moore. This was their land that they had inherited from their parents, Richard and Mimi Moore. Roberto had been their loyal employee for 19 years. His death was a devastating blow to Roger and Gus, and they took it very, very hard. Roberto had started off working out in the fields as a farmhand and eventually worked his way up to being the foreperson. And their farmland was extensive. They had about 1,800 acres, and that included rice fields, alfalfa sprouts, wheat, as well as a walnut orchard. It was a huge swath of fertile land that was very, very valuable. And both Roberto, along with his younger brother Eduardo, had become two of the most trusted employees of the Moore brothers. As the foreperson, Roberto's main role was to get the land ready for each upcoming season, the irrigation, installing sprinklers, just making sure everything was prepped for the harvesting of their crops and everything got done properly. Eduardo came on board working under his brother, who mentored him, teaching him all the tricks of the trade. The Moore brothers relied heavily on Roberto to keep the farm running smoothly. He had become so close with the family, and he earned his place, and he pretty much was responsible for the entire operation. And part of his role as foreperson was the operation of the panel junction box that controlled the watering of the land. Because Roberto was not only their most trusted employee, the Moore brothers also had a great deal of respect for him as well, not just as a farm worker, but as a friend, and eventually he was considered a part of the family. 19 years will do that. They treated Roberto and Eduardo as if they were their own sons. But Roger and Gus did have their own sons. Roger's son is 48-year-old Paul Moore, and his cousin, who is Gus's son, is 47-year-old Peter Moore. I'll do my best to keep the Moores straight as we go along here for you listening. It's a lot of basic names here that can get mixed up pretty easily. So Peter, the son of farm owner Gus, had stepped away from the Moore family farm to venture off into starting his own landscaping and irrigation business on the other side of town. Paul lives nearby the farm and still works for his father Roger and his uncle Gus. Investigators spoke to the fathers and the sons, and one of the sons seemed to think that things malfunctioning and breaking down on the farm was a regular occurrence, and to them, this must have been one of those unfortunate times. But after investigators had their initial conversations with the Moore family, they spoke to some of the farmhands to see if there had been any problems recently between any of them that they could identify. Did anyone seem to have a grudge against Roberto for some reason? Was there a dispute or a disagreement? Nobody really seemed to think that there was anything like that. By all accounts, Roberto was well-liked and treated everyone fairly and with respect. But there was a strange rumor going around that Roberto may have had a problem with the street gang that is centered in the Los Angeles area called MS-13. How does all of this tie in? Well, some of these parts of Northern California are popular places to grow marijuana. Sometimes there is gang activity involvement. Maybe there are other things going on in the area, and perhaps Roberto unwittingly stumbled upon some illegal activities as he was making his rounds. And even though gang activity may be centered in Southern California, it's not uncommon for Colusa County to have its fair share of street gang activity as well, according to local law enforcement. And because of the waterways and the landscapes, it has been a place for gang-related homicides to have occurred and for victims to be dumped in and around the areas surrounding these farmlands. But at this point in the investigation, it is only rumor and conjecture, but still needing to be looked further into. However, and this is just my own commentary, I don't know if using bombs is a common thing for street gangs. It's possible, I guess, but I really can't recall ever hearing about anything of the sort happening. I'll talk more about that later, too. So 2 days after Roberto's death, one of the Moore sons, Paul, showed up at the Colusa police station with a piece of evidence that he happened upon. He showed them a piece of metal. It had some threaded parts. It was a large screw or a bolt. And according to Paul, it is not related to the utility box, and it had no reason to be in the area of the blast. So investigators were interested because if this screw did not belong to any component of the box, then it lends to the idea that there was a device that had been planted inside, and quite possibly, this screw could be linked back to something or someone. In the meantime, with the rumors about gangs floating around, investigators decided to go back out to the farm and talk to some of the farm workers to try to sort that out, to see if there was any validity to it. But nobody reported ever seeing any sort of illegal activity, nor did they ever see any drugs being cultivated anywhere near or on the Moore farm. But one of the farmhands did give investigators a tantalizing bit of information. He said that Peter Moore, Roger's son, he had an issue with Roberto being made the foreperson of the family farm, and that he was pretty envious of that. And yes, Peter does operate his own landscaping business, but that wasn't by choice. He had been kicked out of the family business many years earlier, following a huge blowout with his dad and his uncle. Ever since then, Peter made no secret of the fact that he did not like Roberto. He felt as though that Roberto was stepping on his toes. And as time passed, Peter's resentment grew more and more intense. So investigators circled back to Roger to ask him to fill in some of the blanks here about the relationship between his nephew Peter and Roberto. Roger indicated that he knew that since Roberto was promoted to the position of foreperson, that things turned really bad between his nephew and Roberto. It was contentious before that, but that really pushed things over the edge. Tensions escalated, and eventually Dad and Uncle made the decision to kick Peter off the property and out of the family business. And all of this stemmed from a desire to gain control over the family farm. Roberto was given the enormous responsibility of running the daily operations of the entire place, and Peter was essentially ousted with no stake in the farm any longer. Roger also told investigators that a few weeks earlier, Peter had sent him numerous angry voice messages, and he had saved those messages, which he played for them. In one message, Peter said, "Hey Roger, this is Pete Moore. I'm really disgusted, absolutely disgusted. And what's really sad is you've got those Ayala boys over there ripping you off blind. And very upset with you too, that you couldn't see that my dad is a douchebag." In another message, Peter ranted about being exiled and disowned from his own family's farm after putting 21 years of his life into it, stating, "We're screwed now, Roger, and I'm not going to get the chance to farm my father's ground. My father, that's right." Peter Moore did not mince words. He was not hiding the fact that he was extremely upset with his family over what he perceived as being passed over for Roberto, who wasn't part of their family. But the thing is, it's not only the fact that Roberto had been made the foreperson, but also since he's been essentially banished from the family farm, Peter got the idea in his head that Roberto was going to become the beneficiary of his share of the family fortune, and he expressed this sentiment in at least one of his voicemails. Roger did say that he never saw or thought that Peter would act out physically violent towards Roberto. However, it had crossed his mind that perhaps it might have been a good idea to look into obtaining a restraining order against Peter. But it was actually Roberto himself who said he did not want that hanging over him, probably figuring that things would blow over if they just let it be, and that it's possible that a restraining order might incite Peter even more. Peter Moore suddenly shot to the top of the suspect list in the investigation into Roberto's murder. But investigators aren't quite ready to bring Peter in for that line of questioning just yet. They need to gather some more facts first. So they went and spoke to his cousin, Roger's son, Paul. They needed to know if he had seen Peter on or around the family farm anytime recently. How long ago was it when you last saw Peter there? Paul said it was about 5 days prior to the explosion that killed Roberto. Paul told him that with Peter's landscaping business, his dad and uncle permitted him to dump any excess dirt that he had from any of his projects on the family property. And it just so happened that the last time he saw Peter dumping dirt, it was in the field near the location of the utility box that exploded. So now investigators not only have a potential motive, they also know that Peter did in fact have unrestricted access to the farm, despite being banished from the family business. Investigators also question the nature of Peter's relationship with Roberto. And Paul made it clear, Peter did not like Roberto, not at all. And Paul was able to produce some hostile text messages in his phone from his cousin regarding Roberto. And in one of the messages, there was a direct threat that Peter made against him. In addition to this, Roberto had recently suffered some sort of shoulder injury and was off work for a period of time. In a text message that was sent to Paul, Peter said, quote, "When his wing heals, his ass is mine." Also, based on some of the text messages that Peter sent to Paul, investigators were able to conclude that Peter was in the area of the farm where the explosion took place the day prior to Roberto's murder. And in speaking to a woman who was married to one of the farm workers, she told investigators that Peter told her that he had signed up for some karate lessons because he was getting ready to get into a physical fight with Roberto. With the information gathered thus far, it gave investigators enough probable cause to go ahead and get a search warrant for Peter Moore's house. They showed up, much to Peter's surprise, and seized all of his electronic devices, his computer, his cell phone, all that stuff. And what they were looking for was a search history. That good old search history. Stuff like how to build a bomb, how to make a bomb, how to make explosives, etc. They told him that they'd uncovered some information that there were problems between him and Roberto. And Peter readily admitted that he didn't like the guy, but insisted that he did not have anything to do with Roberto's death. So investigators feel as though they have a pretty strong motive when it comes to Peter, actually a very strong motive, as he clearly had an axe to grind with him. He made direct threats against the victim by way of text message and various witnesses, and they also know that he was in the area the day before Roberto was murdered. But the search of Peter's house turned up nothing. The search of his electronic devices turned up nothing. There was zero evidence anywhere in the house that linked him to anything related to the bomb or the building of a bomb. Without a direct link to the bomb itself, all investigators have is circumstantial evidence and conjecture. And it caused their investigation to sputter to a halt. But in the meantime, the forensics lab is taking their time in their analysis of the bomb's parts, or what is left of them. But despite everything being blown to pieces, they still had a lot to work with in terms of evidence gathering. Many of the pieces were covered in explosive residue, and that was carefully collected and sent to the lab for examination. And what those tests reveal was the explosive residue was nitroglycerin. So are my dreamers ready for a short lesson in chemistry? Because I'm not, but here we are. According to this website with some strange letters that I'll just probably post in the show notes, it says that nitroglycerin is an oily, colorless liquid, but also a high explosive that is so unstable that the slightest jolt, impact, or friction can cause it to spontaneously detonate. Since the molecule contains oxygen, nitrogen, and carbon, when it explodes, a great deal of energy is released as the atoms rearrange to form new molecules with strong stable bonds, such as nitrogen, which is in the air we breathe, and carbon monoxide. It is the speed of the decomposition reaction that makes the nitroglycerin such a violent explosive. Unlike burning, which can only travel as fast as the flame front can move through the material, high explosives are decomposed almost instantaneously by a supersonic shock wave passing through the material. This instantaneous destruction of all the molecules in the sample is called the detonation, and the rapid expansion of hot gases that results is what causes the destructive blast. One advantage of nitroglycerin over some other high explosives like TNT is that no solid forms of carbon in the form of soot or smoke is produced when the explosive is detonated. So this allows nitroglycerin to be used to make smokeless powders, which is advantageous to artillery gunners whose vision won't be obscured by smoke resulting from the explosives. Nitroglycerin does have one big disadvantage in that it is very, very unstable. To be able to be used as an explosive, it has to be able to withstand the jolting and bumping of the manufacturing process without detonating, as well as its transportation to where it's going to be used. Many people have been killed trying to use nitroglycerin for useful purposes such as mining. But a Swedish chemist, a guy you may have heard of named Alfred Nobel, you know, the guy with the Peace Prizes and how he wrote his entire family out of his fortune, leaving everything in a trust fund for the awarding of those prizes. Yeah, that guy. He was the one who was plugging away in Stockholm, developing the use of nitroglycerin as an explosive. He manufactured it by very, very carefully mixing glycerol with nitric and sulfuric acids. But as a result of several explosions in his lab, including one that killed his own brother and several other people, Swedish authorities were like, no, you can't do this anymore. Experimenting with nitroglycerin was essentially banned in the city limits of Stockholm. And Alfred was like, well, then forget you guys. I'll just move my science stuff over to a large barge that I parked on Lake Mälaren. So in 1864, Alfred was able to start mass producing nitroglycerin. And in order to try and make this stuff safer to handle, he experimented with a variety of additives. Before long, he realized that if he mixed the nitroglycerin with a type of clay called kieselguhr, and in doing so, it turned the liquid into a paste, which he shaped into rods that were a good size suitable for inserting into drilled holes. And in 1867, Alfred patented his explosion sticks and called them dynamite. So Alfred's invention of dynamite brought about a new, safe explosive that had many industrial uses like mining, quarrying, demolition, things of that sort. And I know this is like way off topic, but when there was warfare, Alfred's inventions were being used to fuel the war machines on both sides of the battles. Alfred himself, described as a pacifist, continued to produce the explosives, but was under the impression that they would be considered so destructive that neither side would want to use them, thereby leading to the elimination of war. As you know, this is certainly not the case, and wars have been proven to be massively destructive, and this includes both sides using his inventions. And incidentally, when Alfred's other brother, Ludwig, died, a newspaper accidentally published an obituary for Alfred instead. So when he's sitting there reading his own obituary, he was suddenly saddened to see that he was going to be forever remembered as the person who developed the explosives used in wars to cause so much death and destruction. This is what caused Alfred to leave the great fortune that he had amassed, to instigate the Nobel Peace Prizes, a legacy for which he preferred to be remembered for, which he is. Sorry about the side story, but I hope that was kind of interesting because I thought it was. Okay, so nitroglycerin residue was found on the fragments of what was left of the bomb. And they were able to reach that determination by August 11th, a little more than 3 weeks after Roberto's death. And because of that, being the main component of dynamite, they knew for sure that somebody developed an explosive device that was meant to be detonated by the intended victim as soon as the box panel was opened. And because Roberto was the only person authorized to handle the water control panel, investigators were fairly certain that he was targeted. So as this investigation is moving forward, a random envelope was received at the police station. It was a bizarre envelope. It was like a large manila envelope, and a label maker was used to print the address of the police station, and in the corner it said Ayala case, also printed with the label maker. This envelope also had 8 stamps on it, which police believe was done so that the person mailing the thing did not have to approach the counter inside the post office, but rather could drop it off in any mailbox around town. So it immediately raised suspicions, and investigators dropped it very quickly on the desk and retrieved items to handle the envelope without further contaminating any possible evidence. Inside, there was a letter, and it said that the killing of Roberto Ayala was a targeted hit for the Mexican cartel, and that members of the MS-13 gang were hired to carry out the hit. And the reason was because Roberto was causing problems for a drug cartel in Mexico. So this letter is awkward, but this is what it said, and it was all printed using a label maker. Why am I helping you? I received another package via United States Postal Service Target 2. I will not take this job because the info I received is wrong. I got name, age, vehicle, descript, plate number, and location. The target is brother of Target 1 and drives a Chevy. This vehicle info is same as the first job. White Ford, same plate number. I finally found the Ford, and it is now driven by some young guy, not the brother. Since I will not take this job, it will soon be reassigned. Someone will take it. The next guy might not catch the error in info, and the wrong person will die. I would decline anyway because I saw Target 2 with his girls, and I can't deal with that. Target 2 knows that the Mexico connection, and that is the reason for the relocating. Will not help Target 2. They will find him. He needs to be careful. They gave me 2 months for this job. It will be reassigned in 5 weeks. Whoever is driving Ford is very much in danger. So essentially, this letter is saying that there is another target of another hit, and it is Roberto's brother, Eduardo. And because this is the second time the MS-13 gang has come up in the investigation, investigators are taking this threatening letter pretty seriously, and so they headed over to talk to Eduardo right away. They can only tell him that he might be in danger, but they can't tell him any more than that. Just that they received a tip that it was related to Roberto's death and that he's a target. And Eduardo is worried, but he made the decision that he wasn't going to tell his family about it because they would freak out. Investigators also told Eduardo that the gang has made a threat against the person who was now driving Roberto's truck, and that person was Eduardo's nephew, Jesus. So Eduardo did what he could to take as many precautions as he could without raising any alarms. And then a second letter arrived at the police station. This envelope was smaller, but still manila. It still had the label maker used to print the address, more postage than necessary, and the letter was also written entirely using the label maker. Whoever wrote it claimed to be an assassin with the MS-13 street gang and is sending a warning that a hit has been taken out on Eduardo. But the author has said that he is not the one that is going to carry out this hit, even though he is military trained, but you need to warn him because MS-13 will find someone else to carry it out, that the deal is done, that this is set to happen. Okay, so dreamers, if you're thinking that these elaborate letters are just a ruse, like a red herring, so to speak, to send investigators off into wild goose chases, then yeah, you're on track with what I'm thinking and what investigators are thinking too. These are not the actions and behaviors when it comes to gang-related criminal activity. It's pretty much unheard of for any gang to send the police a full confession and an explanation as to why this is happening. They just simply don't do that. They're not going to waste their time. I mean, do you know how time-consuming it would be to type out a letter using a label maker? And really, if you're a street gang assassin, are you really going to be in possession of a label maker to begin with? Because you're a gangster, but you're a stickler for organization? Not saying that there isn't a gangbanger out there somewhere in the world with a label maker organizing his files or his spice rack, but come on, let's be realistic. It isn't likely. Also included in this letter is a second sheet of paper, and it was the actual diagram of the bomb itself. They knew right away based on the parts that had been collected and what was depicted in the diagram. It showed how a rat trap was used with a heavy screw as a drop weight, as well as gasoline for an accelerant, and it was all fashioned to detonate as soon as someone opened the control panel door. So investigators arrived at the conclusion, if they could figure out who sent this letter, then they've got their killer. This is the person who constructed the bomb and placed it in the control panel box. Investigators went ahead and sent the letters and the envelopes off to be analyzed for any kind of evidence that might link the killer, such as DNA, fingerprints, or fibers, or whatever. But that was going to take some time. And in the meantime, Eduardo has to remain super vigilant because of the threat that is on his life. It's still out there. Even though investigators suspect it's a hoax, it's still coming from the actual killer. It's the gang involvement part that is likely untrue. Who knows if the killer is really going to target Eduardo, or if possibly they're trying to get him to leave or run him out of town out of fear. The MS-13 gang angle was thoroughly investigated, and there was nothing that they found that linked MS-13 as having anything to do with Roberto's murder or the letters that were sent to police. And despite all the conjecture surrounding Peter Moore, there still wasn't any evidence against him either, other than some circumstantial stuff. There is no hard evidence just yet definitively linking Peter to the bomb and the killing. So nearly a month later, Paul, the prime suspect's cousin, contacted detectives and they went to pay him a visit at his place. He happened to find another large bolt in the field near the control panel that exploded, and it looked like it had been through some sort of explosion itself because it was all messed up and charred. Paul seemed to genuinely want to help figure out who killed their worker and friend, Roberto. So he's been keeping his eyes open for anything out of place that he happened across. Though the case is kind of moving a little slow, the only person in this whole entire mess who seems to have any sort of problem with Roberto was Peter. Like everyone who knew him said in the beginning, everybody liked Roberto. And Peter did not even try to hide the fact that he had a problem with him. However, when interacting with Paul, investigators had a small inkling that he may have had his own motives for being so helpful to the investigation, like perhaps as a way to throw detectives off his own trail here, which can happen. Guilty suspects in the beginning may come off as helpful because they not only want to be viewed as not a suspect, but they also want to keep themselves close to the investigation. So they might be privy to what police might know or don't know. But they had to ask Paul just to make sure. Did he have a problem with Roberto? And he said no, he really liked the guy. He worked hard for their family for a long time. Does he know anything about building bombs? And Paul laughed and he said not even remotely aware of how to do anything electrical. But the fact is, there wasn't anything pointing to Paul. Peter clearly had a bone to pick with Roberto. There was evidence of that. So investigators and the community have two clear and present suspects here. Peter Moore and the MS-13 gang. And people were pretty much divided as to who they thought were responsible. As investigators are mulling all of this over, they received information that the bolt that was used as a drop weight in the bomb seems to have come from a piece of farming equipment. So this got them thinking. Perhaps the device itself was built on the farm. Remember, they found absolutely nothing at Peter's house that had anything remotely related to any of the materials the bomb was constructed out of. So they decided that they needed to look in the workshop area of the Moore family farm, which Roger and Gus gave investigators permission to search. And with all of the tools and stuff inside the workshop, yeah, this was definitely a place that bomb could have been built. Every component of the bomb is likely to have been found there. And also, they found some new bolts, very similar, if not exact, to the ones that they found near the site of the explosion, or at least the ones that Paul found. Bolts that were still shiny and in good condition. But when they asked Roger if Peter had been in the shop, he said not since he was kicked off the farm, and that was a long time ago. So they're thinking that Peter doesn't have access to the workshop. So in figuring out what to do next, how to further this investigation along, they decided that they wanted to surveil both Peter and Paul, the cousins. So they surreptitiously installed GPS devices on both of their vehicles so that they can monitor all of their comings and goings. The hope is to see when and where they go places and will bring about some new leads and possibly some answers. But also, it is in the hopes of making sure that they keep Eduardo and his family out of harm's way, to make sure that nobody tampers with his vehicle or comes around Eduardo's place of residence, because that threat against him is still looming. And if this case wasn't already strange enough, it got even stranger. Investigators with the ATF and the local law enforcement did make regular visits to the farm to talk to people or to look for more evidence because, you know, bomb fragments could go pretty far, so you never know what might turn up. In October, about 3 months after Roberto's death, ATF agents were driving through the farm when they suddenly blew a tire. They pulled over, and what they found was completely bizarre. Someone had set up a series of homemade spikes along the road on the ranch that was definitely meant to flatten tires. They were harvester sickles that had been welded onto some large flat washers, so these things were sticking point up. There were several of them all over the road. And they had not been there for very long because they weren't showing any signs of being weathered or rusted. They were placed there to sabotage vehicles attempting to drive through that particular area of the farm located close to the site of the explosion. In the meantime, the lab had come up with results of their analysis of the letters that supposedly came from the MS-13 assassins. One male leg hair was found stuck to the adhesive of one of the address labels printed with that label maker. And that leg hair was going to be able to provide investigators with a DNA profile. They compared the DNA to all known MS-13 gang members in the database, but there was no match. The lab also found some fingerprint ridge detail on the adhesive side of some of the self-sticking postage stamps. And DNA was also present under those stamps too. Now, they have to work on finding a match to that genetic material. When it came to the spikes that flattened the tire of the special agent's car, they were really very interested in figuring out who made them and who placed them there, and where the materials to fashion them came from. Because Eduardo Ayala happened to be working in the field at that time of year, they started with him. They showed him the spike and asked him, "Can you tell us where this came from?" Eduardo was stunned. He was like, "Where did you get this?" And they told him they were planted on the ground at the farm. And he was like, "I know who made these. I saw Paul Moore making these in the workshop a few days ago." Investigators were like, "What?" It was sometime after they had searched the workshop looking for evidence that Eduardo saw Paul welding those harvester sickles onto those large washers. Eduardo and another co-worker came into the shop and saw Paul making those exact spikes, which was totally bizarre as they have no use on the farm at all. And then they were buried in the dirt along the road that law enforcement had been using in their comings and goings to and from the bombing location throughout the investigation. So when Eduardo saw Paul grinding these things down and welding them together, he asked him if he needed any help, and he was basically told to go handle his own business. So now investigators are thinking that Paul Moore is deliberately attempting to sabotage the investigation. And that changed the entire trajectory of the case. Paul now became the focus. He was now at the top of the suspect list. They thanked Eduardo for the info and reminded him, "Watch your back." So now that the investigation was feeling like it was back at square one, the detectives needed to start all over and speak to people about Paul now. They started with his ex-wife, a woman named Trinity. They'd been divorced for a few years by the time Roberto was murdered, and they continued to co-parent a teenage son. They asked her about the nature of the divorce. Was it bad? Was it acrimonious? And she told them that Paul had been investigated for bugging her phones during the divorce. He had devices planted in her cell phone, in her home phone, and he recorded conversations that she had with her family, friends, and her attorney. And he tried to use some of those recordings against her in court. He was investigated for it, but nothing really ever came of it. The detectives asked Trinity for her opinion on Peter, her ex-husband's cousin. And she was like, "Yeah, he's got a short fuse, somewhat of a temper, but honestly, Paul is more of the type of person that would do something like what happened to Roberto." And when they asked her the all-important question, "Does Paul know how to make bombs?" Remember, Paul laughed off the insinuation, saying that he didn't know the first thing about electronics or bomb making. But Trinity was like, "Yeah, he does. Early on in the marriage, his friends used to hang out in the garage and they'd make these little bombs, homemade bombs. As a matter of fact, he and his bomb-making friends got in some legal trouble when a small improvised explosive detonated and they injured themselves." So the more investigators are figuring out here about Paul, the less he's looking like the innocent cousin of the two. So next they talked to Trinity and Paul's teenage son. And he said before the divorce, he and his dad used to tinker in the garage all the time. His dad was very intelligent and very handy. He had a wide range of skill sets, including welding, mechanical work, electrical stuff, repairing, fixing, do-it-yourselfing. He's the kind of handy person who can take a diagram and build the actual thing depicted in it. One of his favorite hobbies is building radio-controlled airplanes and flying them in the open fields with his son. Paul had showed his son how to build these airplanes from the kits and get them flying. And this is a guy who told officers with a straight face that he knew absolutely nothing about electronics. But Paul's son was like, "No, he showed me how to fix all the electronic things in my car, how to install electronics. And what's more, working with electronics had been a favorite pastime of Paul's ever since he was a child." His son called Paul an electrical genius. He knows his way around electronics with a blindfold on. So Paul Moore definitely has the skills to put together a bomb. But is he diabolical enough to try and frame his own cousin for it? Maybe. So as investigators work to unravel this case, Eduardo is still working on the farm, working shoulder to shoulder with Paul, the man who has become the prime suspect and likely the person who issued those very threats against his own life. So it was very nerve-wracking for him this time waiting for investigators to put enough evidence together to get that warrant for Paul's arrest. And both Eduardo and Paul at times could feel the mutual tension. Paul could see Eduardo was a little bit off, and Eduardo knew Paul was suspected of murdering his brother. Not an easy thing to have to go through day in and day out at work. But Eduardo was pretty sure Paul knew that he knew something was up. And in the meantime, the investigators were still keeping daily tabs on the GPS devices that they had placed on both Paul and Peter's cars. Because if there was indeed another bombing incident, they wanted to know if either one of them were in the vicinity. But it was actually on Thanksgiving Day, about 4 months into the investigation, that they realized that Paul's vehicle's GPS was no longer pinging for them. So they decided to drive out to Paul's house to see what might be going on with it. When they got there, they didn't see Paul's car, but they did see him standing in his front window, staring them down. The officers held eye contact with Paul for a moment. Because they really had no reason to go there or no excuse to be there, they just decided to drive away. But then, as they were driving down the road, they noticed that Paul was actually following them in his truck. So as the detective was driving, he attempted to pick up a little bit of speed, but Paul did the same thing. The detective stepped on it a little bit more, and Paul did also. Eventually, the detective reached speeds of about 85 miles or 136 kilometers per hour, and Paul is still right on their tails. So the detective slammed on his brakes and Paul went around him and sped off, going at least 95 miles or 152 kilometers an hour. Paul's actions, chasing the detectives the way that he did, was very strange. Like, nobody does that. So with everything in the investigation that they were able to gather up on Paul Moore, and this included the spikes that he had planted and the high-speed chase with the police, and his history involving homemade bombs, it was enough for a judge to sign off on a search warrant for Paul's home. Several items were recovered that linked him directly to the bomb. They found some fishing line that was very similar to the fishing line that was used to hang the drop weight bolt. They found some rat traps, which isn't unusual, but there seemed to be more than a normal amount that a household would need. They found a roll of stamps that were the same exact stamps that were used to mail the two anonymous letters to the police. They discovered in Paul's filing cabinets, all of his file folders were labeled using, you guessed it, gangster label makers. And they found the label maker itself too. Now, on their own, none of these items is really uncommon to find in anybody's house. But they all happened to be tied to the investigation in one way or another. They did not find any explosives. But then suddenly, a detective found one piece of evidence that could have only come from the bomber. While searching the home, he happened to notice a pad of paper sitting near a window. And the sunlight coming through that window was striking that pad of paper just right in that it illuminated some indentations on that paper that were left behind from the last page that was used. And when they took a closer look at it, it was the diagram of the bomb that was included in the second letter sent to the police. Right there, indented on that blank paper. This was the linchpin of their case. And they wanted to make sure nothing happened to this pad of paper. So they placed it in a protective aluminum briefcase that was lined with foam, and it was literally handcuffed to the detective who transported it directly to the lab. They could see the defeat on Paul's face when he realized what they had seen in those indentations on his pad of paper. Later on, the lab would report that they found 8 fingerprints on that pad, and every single one of them belonged to Paul Moore. So the day finally came. Paul and Eduardo were working in the shop on the farm when police came in and took Paul into custody for Roberto's murder. It was a huge relief for the entire Ayala family, who were thinking that the investigation was never going to reach a conclusion. But those detectives, they stayed on it until they had enough to make that arrest. The court issued warrants for DNA samples to be taken from both cousins, Peter and Paul. The DNA excluded Peter as a suspect in the murder, but the DNA came back as a match to Paul, as well as the fingerprint ridge on the back of those stamps. Now, from the beginning, everyone was thinking that this was Peter's doing. He was the angry one. He was hostile towards Roberto. He'd even made threats. The question left was, what was Paul's motive? Well, those answers came from a document that was recovered from his own personal computer. I'll circle back to that in a moment, but first let's talk about some of the details regarding the Moore family dynamics that came out in court. The Moore family was in a great state of disharmony and dissension, and it was all centered around Paul and Peter and their dissatisfaction with their position in the hierarchy of the family. Peter had insisted that his grandfather told him on his deathbed that he wanted him to farm the walnut orchards. But apparently Peter had been terribly abused and ostracized by his own father, Gus, and he never allowed Peter to tend to any of the farming, and he ended up doing his own landscaping work that he hated doing. Peter had developed a great deal of anger and animosity towards the entire Moore family ever since adolescence, even going so far as to try and talk to his grandmother and asking her to disown his own father, believing his uncle Roger would be more diplomatic. On numerous occasions, Peter had threatened harm to his dad, his uncle, and Roberto, which is where all of the threatening texts and statements came from. And then Peter became really livid when his dad and uncle spent Father's Day with Roberto while Peter and Paul were not invited. This was just a month before the killing. Paul, Roger's son, he was the one that suffered in silence while Peter was more outwardly angry. When his computer was searched, investigators discovered a document that Paul entitled "My Life." In it, he bitterly complained about his entire life growing up on the farm. He felt that the whole family had mistreated him, and that included his cousin Peter, who he called a pussy throughout the document. Paul said he was always the one stuck driving the crappy tractor, while Peter was always given the one with the air-conditioned cab. Because if Peter didn't get what he wanted, he acted like a prick to everyone. He wrote that the employees, specifically Roberto and Eduardo, were given much more freedoms and leeway while they were at work, and that included being able to enjoy a cold beer while on the job. They could take and use any of the farm vehicles for their own personal use, and they were paid throughout the winter. Peter and Paul were never afforded these kinds of perks. Paul complained that he was treated worse than any other employee, that he worked harder than all of them, and he was never given a raise. Paul wrote that his father was stupid and that his dad always raved about how smart and intellectually superior Roberto was. And for the life of him, Paul could not understand what he had ever done to deserve to be treated so badly by his own family. Peter and Paul emerged into adulthood with very different personalities and the manner in which how they dealt with the mistreatment of their family. But the problems they had, the grievances that they shared, and the direction that their lives took were very similar. Both wanted to have supervisory jobs on the farm their entire lives, and it never happened for either one of them. They both attempted to pursue other lines of work and other ventures. Paul had a failed construction business. Peter had a failed sod business. And both of them struggled with health problems as they got older. And both Paul and Peter had a tremendous amount of animosity towards Roberto. He had worked for their fathers for 19 years, and he ascended all the way up to the top position of foreperson. And he was in charge of regulating the water levels in the rice fields, which was really important to the farm. Over the years, Roberto had become Gus and Roger's most trusted and respected employee, and he far surpassed Peter and Paul in the eyes of their own fathers. To make matters worse, Roberto was able to override both Peter and Paul when it came to decisions about the farm. For example, Roberto had traveled with Peter to a seminar about running a sod business, but when Peter said he was interested in purchasing a harvester, Roberto talked to Roger and Roger shot the idea down immediately. Then there was a time that Roberto and Paul had a disagreement over a design for a mud chisel, and Roger sided with Roberto. The agitation both of the Ayala brothers caused Paul pushed him to the point where he thought that they were trying to take over his life and his place in the family. Paul's document was essentially a personal declaration peppered with feelings of jealousy, competition, and inadequacy. Paul had it in his mind that his father and uncle were going to write him and Peter out of their will and leave the entire farm to Roberto. So he hatched a plan to eliminate Roberto and pin the murder on Peter. He built the bomb, he planted it, and just waited. He knew Roberto would be the one to check the control box eventually, which he did. But as the investigation started closing in on him, he started doing things to try and throw authorities off, like mailing those letters and laying down those homemade spikes. And all that ended up doing was bringing about more evidence against him. After a 3-week trial in 2013, a jury deliberated for 5 hours and came back with a guilty verdict against Paul Moore for the murder of Robert Ayala. He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. In 2016, Roberto's family was awarded a judgment of $20 million for his wrongful death. Today, Paul Roger Moore is 56 years old and serving out his time in Avino State Prison in Avino, California. Remember what I said in the beginning about the senselessness of these things? Well, Gus and Roger Moore confirmed that they never changed their wills to list Roberto Ayala as a sole heir to the family farm, and that they never had any intention to do so. And that will bring this episode of California Dreaming to a close. Please come over to our Facebook group, and if you haven't done so yet, request to join. It is there we discuss the cases that we cover. We share our thoughts and opinions, not only about our show, but any other podcasts that you enjoy listening to, documentaries that you've watched, books that you've read. We also share about current news stories, breaking news, posts about your pets, funny memes, anything you want to post, please come over and share. You also can go over to the show's Facebook page and like that page and leave a review or a recommendation. You can also follow us on Twitter at California Pod and Instagram at California Dreaming Pod. I'm a little bit behind on birthdays, but I'm going to start with wishing a happy birthday to Kim H., who is one of our admins, on February 10th. Renee C. on February 12th. Christine H., who is, I believe, an admin over there at Real Life Real Crime. Her birthday is February 13th. Carla H., who is the host of There Might Be Cupcakes, on February 16th. It was Fred's 6th birthday on February 17th. And Rachel Y. and Tiana S. on February 23rd, which is coming up in a couple days. California Dreaming is brought to you by the Orbital Jigsaw Network, a podcast production company on a mission to create some of the best podcasts to listen to, with an amazing roster of shows with content including true crime, history, sports, entertainment, gaming, and social media. So visit our website at www.orbitaljigsaw.com. You will find links to all of our podcasts, as well as a link to our merchandise store on TeePublic. Again, it's www.orbitaljigsaw.com. Thank you again so much for listening. I'm your host, Roseanne. Until next time, sweet dreams.